I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Peter ran a little over, which is pretty normal for Peter, so I'll try to catch us up here a little bit. So welcome to Managing the Agile Process. My name is Aaron Bjork. I'm a program manager here at Microsoft, and I work on Team Foundation Server. So just kind of out of curiosity as we get started, how many of you guys are using TFS today? So I know. Okay. How many are using the hosted preview? So I know. Okay. How many of you are part of Agile teams? Okay, and then how many of you actually do work on Agile teams? Like writing code, you're not, okay, good. Okay, great. There's really kind of two parts to this talk that I want to talk about today. The title is Managing the Agile Process, but I really sort of have retitled it Unmanaging the Agile Process almost. So this isn't Scrum 101. I don't want to talk a whole bunch about burn down charts and things like that. I want to instead talk about teams, environments, and things like that, and how we get the most out of our teams when we're trying to run an Agile process. Yeah, it's good to be home. So I was born down here in the South End. I went to school at the University of Washington up here in the North. I work here in Redmond, where we're at, and I live down here in the South End. So I'm kind of hoping Mercer Island might be next. That's a really nice area there in the middle. I've got it sort of triangulated. We'll see. A little bit about me. I've been married 15 years. I've got three kids. Anybody have more than three kids? Great. Okay, look around. Go buy those people a beer later tonight. They're the ones that are really working hard. We know that. Got a dog. I play golf. Any golfers in the audience? Few hands. This is sort of my biggest regret in my career is I picked an industry where nobody plays golf. We all play video games and stuff like that. So I love to play golf. So when I'm not here and when I'm not with my family in the few minutes I find in myself, you can find me out on the golf course. Love to read, love to write, or learning to write, actually. I write a monthly column for the Visual Studio Magazine, and I wear jeans every day, so that's a little bit about me. A little bit about my career. So I went to the University of Washington, showing my age there. If you can work it back, you can figure it out. From 96 to 2002, I did a bunch of startups, so a lot of just local consulting companies, startups, dot-coms, you name it. We all kind of did that. And then I came to work for Microsoft in 2002 as a developer. So I was actually a business major in college. Do we have any business majors in the room? A few? Yeah. So I'm not a computer science guy, but I fell in love with writing code and found my way to Microsoft to do that. I have worked in the Visual Studio organization for all of my career. And in 2008, I joined TFS, and I became a program manager. So what that really means is I joined the dark side. So this is where I moved from a role where I had my hands on the keyboard writing code every day to what we really do, which is just create work. So I'm passionate about all things Agile. I fell in love with sort of the Agile movement as a dev and then a dev lead here at Microsoft, and I'm really committed to finding ways that we can make our products at Microsoft here better for Agile teams and really get them out of the way. So, okay. You know, first statement in the Agile Manifesto, I don't want to read this for you, but there's really two pieces. There's the people aspect, which is individuals and interactions, and then there's the tools. So I'm a tools guy, right? I work on TFS. I work on Visual Studio. That's what we do. We sell that. So I will show you a little bit of the tool at the end, and I'll show you some of the improvements that we've made, some of the updates that we're doing, and how hopefully it is going to be better for Agile teams and get out of the way of Agile teams. But what I really want to focus on for the next probably 40 minutes here is individuals and interactions and that aspect of it. So I really call this unmanaging the Agile process. So let's go ahead and get started. I've got three topics that I want to dive into a little bit today, and the first is motivation. I want to talk about how we motivate teams and what we do to them, what we do that maybe demotivates them in a lot of ways. I want to talk about environments and making sure that we have environments for our teams to succeed and that we're building environments. And then I also want to talk about distractions and the types of things that we find in all organizations that just get in the way. And sometimes that can be the tools. All right, so let's start with motivation. Anybody in the room read the book Drive by Dan Pink? Okay, it's a fantastic read. I would highly recommend it, and I'm going to spend about 10 minutes here talking about it. The subtitle of Dan's book is The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. And essentially what Dan Pink does is he outlines And compares and contrasts traditional motivational techniques, which he says are basically like the carrot and the stick, with more modern motivational techniques. And so if you think of the carrot and the stick, it's that you can find two ways to motivate people. You can dangle a carrot in front of them and have them chase that. That carrot can be money, it can be rewards and things like that. So you can do that, right? Or you can beat them with a stick on the other end, which is motivate them with punishment, you know, get it right or I'm going to hurt you type thing. And his point is that those motivational techniques, they work for certain types of jobs, but they top out very, very quickly, and they don't work in creative industries. And to me, building software is definitely a creative industry. It's an industry where we want real people involved. This isn't a perfect science. We need everybody on the team's input. We need all of that. And so Pink outlines three things. He says that if we give people autonomy, mastery, and purpose, that great things will happen. And I want to dig into each one of those three things. You'll see on my slides here, I have a little RS Animate. If you go up to YouTube, don't do it now. If you go up to YouTube and search for Drive and Dan Pink, there's just a fabulous 10-minute sort of video of that outlines the whole book. You could actually watch that, and if you like it, then go buy the book, or maybe you don't even need to buy the book, but really goes into depth on a lot of this stuff. So I'd really encourage you to go check that out. Okay, so when I read Pink's book for the first time and I found these three things, autonomy, mastery, and purpose, I saw a ton of overlap to these words, which are straight from the Agile Manifesto. Individuals, interactions, working software, collaboration, and responding to change. And I think that there's a lot of crossover between these things, and that's what I want to dig into. So let's start with autonomy. Autonomy is normally defined as sort of the urge to direct our own lives. We all want that at some level. How many of you love having people tell you what to do? Right? Yeah. Okay, there's one in the back. Okay. Great. It's clear at least, right? How many of you love it when your spouse tells you everything what to do, right? We all deal with that maybe. How many of you work for micromanagers? Okay. How many of you are micromanagers? How's that? Okay. I think the point I'm trying to make is that autonomy is critical to the success of an agile team. And as I read through Pink's book, I had all these revelations about how we need to give our teams the ability and the empowerment to actually direct what they're doing. And I think that is actually in contrast to sort of our default behavior. Our default behavior is control. And for some reason, as we get into organizations, as you move up in the org chart, as you find your way into a higher position, it's really hard for people to let go and start giving the people that work for them or with them the ability to make decisions. We tend to default to that natural setting, and we start to try to control everything. And when we do that, we kill autonomy, and we take that away from teams. So I want to walk through some examples here of how I think autonomy is really critical to an agile team. And we're going to start with something I call planning and learning. So let's talk about this. Traditional planning looks like this, and you can see we've got value on our y-axis and we've got time on our x-axis. And what I say with traditional planning is that as you start to plan, you get a really high return on investment. You're learning a lot at the beginning, you're kind of uncovering some things, and ROI is very, very high. But over time, that ROI starts to really diminish fast. And if you ask yourself why, the answer is because everything that you're learning beyond is based on assumptions that really aren't proven at the beginning. So if you kind of step back from big projects and you look at what did we set out to do at the beginning, you'll find that planning you did at the end part of planning usually didn't get you a lot, and usually you were wrong, or usually you had to cut it, or you know, it never even made it into the product. So why does ROI diminish quickly? We just talked about this. How is Agile different? Agile's different because Agile tells us that instead of planning forever, we're going to plan what we know, and then we're going to get started, right? We're going to plan, and we're going to get started, and we're going to repeat this process over and over and over again. Love this quote by George Patton. A good plan violently executed now is a better than a perfect plan executed next week. What I love about it is that when I look at program managers, when I look at project managers, we love the second half of that statement. We love perfect plans. We take pride in them. we build specs, right? And we hold them up, and we're so proud of the work that we've done on our spec. But more often than not, I think we've created some waste in that spec because we would have been better off getting started and getting the team involved in what we were doing. So let's look at how Agile does that. An Agile team essentially plans, and then the dotted line is that they execute. So we'll do that for an iteration, and then we'll plan again. And the difference here is that what I say is that that curve starts to go higher and higher and higher because we're learning at the end of each iteration. We're in the midst of what we call Dev 11 or Visual Studio 11 or TFS 11, however you want to, it's 11 something. And we've been working on this for about a year in terms of execution mode, and we planned it for maybe 4 months. And when I look back and I look at all the great things that we came up with in the last month of planning, we're not doing any of them. Okay? We're not doing any of them. But when I look at how much we've learned after we got started, it's tremendous. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, even on a huge product, that we have made much better decisions because we followed this process. Okay, so the idea is that at the end, you get higher return on investment in your planning. The result, obviously better plans, more value. And one of the side effects is that you get working software. If you're doing this right, you're producing value at the end of every iteration, and it's value that works end to end, right? It's not just a single piece that, you know, somebody has to go off and do a bunch of stuff with. It should work end to end. So when we put these two side by side, you know, I just love this debate about traditional planning and agile planning, and I think there's a clear argument that we get more out of agile planning. So let's pause there for a second and say, what does this have to do with autonomy, right? I thought you were talking about autonomy. Well, oops. My point is that if we don't give teams autonomy, what are they going to do? They're going to essentially blindly follow the plan that was laid out at the beginning, and they're going to go back to the left-hand side. And I see this all the time, where we build up these great grand visions of plans, and then we give it to the team to go execute. The problem is we don't also give the team the empowerment to say that you're going to learn along the way, and when you do learn, let's talk about it. And let's go dig into that stuff, and let's decide together what the next course of action is. So this doesn't mean that you give the team just carte blanche to do whatever they want. That's certainly not what I'm arguing. But you've got to create an environment, and you've got to let teams know that they have this autonomy. If you go talk to anybody on your team, and you just go up to them and you say, hey, what would you do differently right now with regards to our product? I guarantee you they will spew out a wealth of knowledge, and a knowledge that you might not even know, because they might not feel empowered to even share it. So I think this is really, really important. We've got to give our teams autonomy. Okay, another aspect of Agile is certainly the concept of a retrospective, where we're going to reflect, we're going to fine-tune and adjust. And, you know, this is straight from the back page of the Agile Manifesto. This is one of the 12 value statements. And I think it's brilliant. I love it. I think we gloss over it and reread it. But when you unpack this, it says the team reflects. Doesn't say management reflects. It says the team reflects. They reflect and then they tune and adjust. So they don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. They don't start over. They tune and adjust, and they adjust their behavior. They don't adjust other teams' behavior. They adjust their behavior. I've been a part of a lot of retrospectives when, boy, everything we decided at the end of it was, God, if like everybody in the world would just change, we could get something done, right? That's not what a retrospective is about. A retrospective is about looking at our own behavior, tuning and adjusting it, and then taking responsibility for it. How are we going to be different? Again, unless your teams feel empowered and have some sense of autonomy, they're not going to do this. They're going to be scared to actually come and say, we want to do something different the next sprint, because they feel like they're going to get shot down or told no. That's not the right way to do it. That's not the way we do it here at XYZ. So autonomy, it's critical to our success here. So my question to you guys is basically, are your teams empowered to make decisions? Just think about it. Do you have an environment where autonomy is valued, where people really, really buy into this stuff and it's valued? Okay. Second, we're going to talk about mastery. Mastery is defined as the desire to get better and better at something that matters. My question here is always, who decides what matters, right? Something that matters. So for myself, something that I'm trying to become a master at is the game of golf. I love the process. It's difficult. There's a lot of failure along the way. But that process is invigorating, and I learn, and I set out this plan for myself. My brother-in-law works here at Microsoft, and we're both golf nerds, and we kind of do this together. We go in these waves, we trade in emails, and, oh, I'm going to work on this, and let's get to the range and go practice. The idea is that we're trying to become masters at it. Mastery is something that's never achieved, but the process of getting there is invigorating and fun and exhilarating. And we've got to find ways to give our teams the ability to become masters, if you will, and get good at something. Tap into that sort of inner core about, you know, they feel really, really good about this stuff. Now, one of the things that I think we do is that we get in the way of mastery. How do we do that? We change priorities, right? So a team falls behind. Well, let's take half a resource, and I love this, half a resource, literally. This guy's going to work half-time on this team as well. And we're going to pull you over here, and we're going to switch that, and, oh, this is now, you know, prize zero bug. Don't get me started, right? We don't let people get good at their jobs. We stand up above them, and we decide for them what they need to be good at. And I think we got to stop doing that. We got to get out of the way and help our teams become masters. One of the really cool things that we did at the beginning of this product cycle is all the teams in TFS, program managers, dev, test, we had what we called our yellow sticky exercises, and we put up the big pillars for the release, and we sat in rooms together, and people went and put their names on what they wanted to work on. That was pretty cool. And there was some trust there for the team. But it was a part of this. It was saying, hey, I'm passionate about what we're doing in terms of code review. I want to go work on that. That's important to me. And we've got to tap into that ability to find mastery on our teams. So another important aspect. And the third is purpose. The third is the yearning to do what we do in the service of something larger than ourselves. So how many of you do volunteer work? Okay. Everybody that's not raising their hand should feel bad about themselves right now. Okay, so why do we do volunteer work, right? Like, I volunteer at my church. I volunteer up at my kid's school. Why? Why do we do that? Anybody? It feels good, right? There's a higher calling there, right? There's something that's tapped into that. That say there's something that's bigger than just my work, right? And we tap into that. It's a part of, again, that inner core of us that we find purpose in it. And I love it, right? So I'm gonna give you guys something here. I'm going to throw up, we all remember, and I say remember, Microsoft Encarta, right? So what's coming next? Wikipedia. Now, this is fascinating. I'm stealing this straight from Pink, so you'll read about this in his book. But I love this. Microsoft Encarta, you know, it was designed to be the encyclopedia of the future, right? It was well-funded. It was well thought out. There was a plan. There was a strategy. And everybody that was involved in it was well-trained and well-paid. Okay? That sounds like a recipe for success, right? You had brilliant people working on this. Instead, what comes along? Instead, we come along with something that is unorganized. People are going to do in their spare time. They're not going to get paid for it. And if you put these two business models side by side, which one would you choose to be successful? If anybody says right, you know, Wikipedia, they're lying. We would all choose that. We would bet on Encarta, right? It's just how we're wired. There's no way this other thing could win. And it did. In a matter of a couple years, Encarta was dead. And you have the largest online encyclopedia ever known to man, called Wikipedia, and it's funded by people that work for free in their spare time. How? How is that possible? It's possible because the people contributing find purpose in it, and it's important to them, and they want to do it. And we've got to find that same ability to do that with our teams, our development teams, our QA teams, our program management teams. We've got to find a way to treat people not as resources, but tap into that purpose and get them energized about it. And I think when we do, we'll see great results. So, do your teams have purpose? That's kind of my point there. All right, let's keep going. We've talked about motivation, and I've kind of given you three things there that I think are important to motivating Agile teams: autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Next, I want to talk about environment. Do you have an environment to succeed? Okay, fast is fun. We all love to go fast. It's just, again, it's part of that, I think, hardwired nature. Nobody likes to go slow, and we could maybe come up with examples where slow is better, but I think, in general, fast is fun. I think there's some great examples of this. When people write code, they like to write code and see it delivered to customers quickly. This is something we've struggled with here at Microsoft. I'll be very transparent. I'm going to show you some demo later, and I'm going to show you features that people coded and tested a year ago, and it's still not in customers' hands, right? That sucks. It really drains the team, and it drains morale. We want to find ways to speed up our process and make it fast, allow our teams to work fast. It's just fun. John Wooden, who is a basketball coach for UCLA, he said, be quick, but don't hurry. And I love this when we talk about going fast. Tom talked about this yesterday in his keynote, that this isn't just about blazing through your backlog, but we want to create environments where we can be very, very quick, but where we don't hurry. Hurry is doing something with excessive speed. We're going too fast at that point. But I think it's great to strive to be quick and find ways to be quick. So how do we do that? We have to kind of analyze that. The first thing that I would say is that we've got to understand what the rules of the road are. So when I leave here, well, I won't drive down 405 when I leave because traffic will suck and I won't be going fast. But when I come to work in the morning, I hop on 405 early in the morning, and I'm driving 65 miles an hour in a 4,000-pound machine, 5 feet, not in front of, but next to, a semi or a big truck or other people, right? We're going fast. We're going very fast, high rates of speed, in what could be considered dangerous objects in these vehicles. How are we able to do that? We're able to do that because we all understand the rules of the road. There's a dotted white line painted on each side of me, and that's my lane, and I know it's my job to stay in it. And I trust that the guy on the other side is going to stay in it as well. Have any of you ever driven on a road maybe that looks like this? I was looking for an image, but I couldn't find one. But where there's like a cliff on one side? Have you ever done that? It's scary, right? And I don't go that fast. But then you see the car coming the other way, and it gets really scary. It's like, you know, but you go by because you trust each other. Now, let me play it differently. I get in my car, I drive to 405 in the morning, and there's no rules of the road, there's no white lines. How fast am I going to get to work? Not very fast. I'm going to be over on the shoulder, like honking and eking my way around, right? It would just be chaos. And this is something that we need to pay attention to with our development teams. What are the rules of the road on your teams? What have you laid out that says, this is how we're going to drive, this is what we're going to adhere to? And I love this because I think when you create these, you give people the guidelines to start going fast. Now you can really focus on delivering value, and fast can become fun. Now there's a flip side to this. The flip side is that you can actually create a lot of rules that don't speed you up, but actually slow you down. And I see this a lot. I'm speaking from experience here at Microsoft, where we create too many road rules. We create so much process that we can't be fast at anything, and it becomes a real hindrance to the team. So one way to think about this in my analogy is, let's say I'm driving down 405, but because we're so scared that people are going to bump into each other, we put a speed bump every 15 feet and a stop sign every 1,000 feet, right? Chances are we're going to be a little bit safer, but we're going to be slow. Nobody's getting home fast on 405 anymore. And that's an example of how I think you can create road rules that actually slow your teams down. So, you know, I would encourage you guys to all look at your own teams. Just think about it and say, what do we ask of our teams? A, do they understand it? Do they understand what the rules are? B, are they actually helping the team go faster? Or are they just getting in the way? We have so many that we're not able to make progress. So that's something to think about. Okay. Next, this is perhaps my favorite, which is, what is your tax bracket? So, who loves to pay taxes? Raise your hand. Okay, we got a couple. Okay, great. Proud Americans. Who does it voluntarily? Excited, right? Okay. Who cheats on their taxes? So, okay, well, got a few that are raising their hands for everything here. Taxes are something that we got to pay attention to, and I want to define what a tax is for a software team. I often talk to customers who come up to me and they go, you know, we're using TFS, but it's like so hard to get our devs to enter their hours. It's just, it's impossible. You know, like I can't get them to enter their hours. And I go, okay, let's walk through the process. And I always ask them, I say, what do you do with the hours once they've entered them? And they kind of look at me and they're like, well, they go into the warehouse and then into the cube. Okay, great. I knew that because we wrote that. So what do you do with the hours though? Well, we have a bunch of reports. Okay. What do you do with the reports? Well, we make sure the team's on track. Okay, so you've just told me that your team, you forced them to enter hours. You've created a road rule there. It's enter hours. And they don't get any value out of it. And it's for you, so you can make sure they're doing their job. Okay, that feels like a tax to me. That doesn't feel like, as a team member, something that I would be excited about doing. So I would flip that around on them and I say, have you thought about talking about to the team about how they can use the hours? And then if you need metrics to keep them on track, or what you perceive to be keeping them on track, talk to them and talk to them about what they can provide to you. But to me, this is taxes. This is how we get in the way of the team. And we start creating this environment where it's like, I want you to do this and I want you to do that. And the team, all they feel like they're doing is paying taxes. I would be, not to discredit anybody that loves paying their taxes, I would be a lot more excited to pay my taxes if for every dollar that I paid in taxes, I could go see the pothole that was fixed or the new street sign that was put up, all right? But what happens when I pay my taxes? It disappears into some black hole, and then I hear about some new program, you know, I don't know, and it's just, you know, that's how this stuff feels to the team as well. And I think we really got to look at this. We got to say, what is the tax bracket that we're making our teams live in? I'll be very personal on this one, that we have four teams right now that are contributing to our web experiences in TFS. I'm going to show you a little bit of this in next. And we're trying to make all the right things happen here and what we call the end game. And I sent out this big email and, you know, I asked them to do certain things. And guess what the reaction was? There was no motivation for them to do any of it. And to be honest, a lot of them haven't done any of it. So I don't blame them. Because there was no value for them. It was just a tax. You know, there was nothing. I should have done it differently. I should have pulled people together and said, hey, here's the problem, guys. How are we going to go fix it? And help me fix it. And I think we're all guilty of this as well. It gets back to that control aspect. But what is your tax bracket? Don't actually shout it out. Anybody recognize these guys? I was going to queue up a video, but I was too nervous that the sound wouldn't work and stuff. But the old TPS reports, right, from Office Space. There's a great clip of, you know, the boss when he comes up and he's asking him, you know, did you get the memo? You know, we got a new cover sheet. And anyway, I could go on and on. But this movie is the epitome of that sort of lack of purpose, lack of autonomy, and tax-rich environment. So watch out for that. How many TPS reports are you collecting? And what do you do with them? I would just go back and think about it when you get back to your office. Print them out, look at them, and say, what value do we actually get out of these things? Are they necessary? And then how high is your team's tax bracket? Make sure you're not putting them in a tax bracket that they don't want to be in or don't belong in. Okay. Let's keep going. Next, I want to talk about done and sort of understanding what your finish line is. You heard Peter talk a little bit about that as well. But this is a great topic for agile teams. When are you done with a software project? You know, when are you done with a task or a sprint? And how do you know? I think you've got to make sure that this is crystal clear all the time for your teams. And I'll give you an example. And it actually relates back to taxes, but I call it, are we there yet? So I took a road trip with my family last summer. We live here in Western Washington, and we went over to Eastern Washington, where there's a little more sun on a regular basis in the summer. And we rented this great little cabin by a lake, and we're there for a week and fished and had a great time. So at the time, my kids were 9, 7, and 6. I have two boys and a girl. My daughter's 6. And we get in the car, and we got about a 6-hour drive ahead of us. Okay? So we get in the car, on the road, driven about half hour. I might be exaggerating. It might have been more like 20 minutes. And what's the question I hear out of my 6-year-old daughter? Are we there yet, right? Right? And I calmly answered, no, Lily, we're not there yet. And what's the next answer, question out of her mouth? Yeah, how much further? When are we going to get there, right? And I said, we've got about another 5 hours to drive. Okay, now, the reason I bring up this example is because the way I answer that question is very, very critical. And it has to do with, my answer was not how far we've driven. So let me play that again, which is, we leave, we've driven for a half hour, and Lily asks me, are we there yet? I say no, and she says, how much further? And I say, we've driven for 30 minutes. She would kind of look at me like, huh? Well, I didn't ask you how far we've driven, I've asked you when we're going to get there, right? And in this particular example, it ended up taking us about 7 hours, so a little longer than planned. The reason was we took a detour for a lunch stop along the way. We found a different place. I did follow my directions carefully, so I wasn't getting lost. And we took a little side trip. We saw something that we wanted to go explore. Now, this is critical because in the end, when we arrived, nobody cared about the estimate I had given. Nobody cared that I had estimated 5 hours. Nobody cared about when Lily asked that we had driven for 30 minutes. What mattered was that we had arrived at our destination. And the reason I use this example, because I find a lot of teams that really put a lot of emphasis on estimates, remaining work, and completed work. The middle one is the one I care about, which is remaining work, because that's what defines the finish line. When are we going to get there? That's what matters. And I see a lot of teams that say, well, we're so good at estimating, and we track all this stuff, and we use it, blah-de-blah-de-blah. I think it's hogwash. I think people know what a good estimate is and what a bad estimate is. I think our goal is not to get to the end and say, wow, we planned for 5 hours and we hit it in 5:05. Like, it was perfect. We were right on our estimate. The key is getting to the destination and getting to the finish line. And I think that we have to be careful that we don't have our teams focused on the wrong goals. So if you want your teams focused on creating perfect estimates and, you know, having this perfect burn down of remaining and completed work that just feels good all the time, then go track that stuff. But I think instead we've got to create an environment where our teams are focused on finishing, on being done. We've got to define it, and then we've got to keep it front and center. So my question to you then is, you know, do your teams have a finish line? Do they understand what it is? And again, are you tracking what's important to getting to the finish line, or are we putting the emphasis on other things? Okay. So that's environment. We've talked a little bit about three things that I think create an environment for success for an Agile team. And the final one is distractions. So simplicity, less is more, right? I love that statement, and I'm a firm believer. I tend to overuse it. But I think that we're seeing this in software. We're seeing this everywhere, in fact, that people are actually gravitating towards solutions, towards products, towards things that actually do a little bit less. And we would rather do less well than more not so well, right? So I love this chair because I forget the name of the architect, but it's kind of been won all these awards as this very sort of simple, very elegant design. If you saw this chair, you would want to go sit in it, right? It's simple. It's less is more. Now, let me tell you a story. Let's say we are trying to build a process to get us from point A to point B. And I define point A as where I'm here right now, and I define point B as building 41, which is there. We're going to design some mechanism to get us there. I could go do a lot of planning, and I could design a mechanism for that. And you might come up with a bunch of different options. One option might be a skateboard. It's really simple, right? Gets me from point A to point B. I can carry it around with me. If it breaks, it's easy to replace, right? Things like that. I could also design the space shuttle, right? I could build a launch pad, I could build something, you know, the orbiter, and I could design something that's very, very complex, okay? And we've got to be careful of this. We've got to be careful that when we're trying to get from point A to point B, that we're not asking our teams to use space shuttles, or we're actually not building space shuttles for our customers as well. And I think we got to pay attention to this. This, anybody know what this is? You see, if you've been in some of my talks before, you've seen it. This is our bug form in DevDiv. So this is what we use to track bugs. Okay? This is actually a real bug. It was closed on 11.2. Cannot clear error on iteration. Greg's in the back. He knows this bug. So he's very familiar with it. It's a real bug. Okay? Let me show you something. You didn't realize something. There's actually, let me go back. There's six tabs up at the top. You see those? Six tabs. Okay? Six tabs of data for a bug. I wrote it down here because I counted before I came. 112 fields. Yeah, this is a space shuttle, folks. This is a space shuttle. Now, the funny part to me is that there's two fields on this form that if you removed them, people would cry. They would go nuts. They would like hunt you down and force you to put them back. Anybody have a guess at what those fields are? It's not assigned to, nope. Not priority, nope. Nope, not closed, not title. You know what it is? If you look right over here, it's two fields called custom 01 and custom 02. <laughs> 112 fields, but the most important ones are the ones that people can do whatever they want with. So this speaks to autonomy, right? Right? You're forcing all this tax, right? This is a space shuttle, folks. And we have some fun. I mean, when I open bugs, sometimes I just go in and put values in fields. I don't know. Let's see what happens. Like, will anybody even notice? I don't know. Nobody has to this day, but and I love what's in that custom 01 kill error. You know, so that means something to that team. But anyway, make sure that you're not overcomplicating things. Make sure that you're not building a process space shuttle. You know, and make sure you're not forcing your teams to use a space shuttle to get from point A to point B. Okay. Who's carrying debt in their life right now? Great, yeah. We love debt, right? Debt is great. Don't we love debt? No, we don't love debt. We're in a world of hurt in terms of the world right now because of the way we've dealt with debt over the past, I don't know, however many years. We won't go into that. I'm not here to talk about debt in that regard. But I think the housing crisis, I think, anybody from Greece? No? Okay, I think what's going on in Greece, you know, like, there's a lot. I mean, what's going on here in America? We've got all kinds of problems with debt, right? We accumulate it. We ignore it. We try to come up with creative formulas to make it go away, but it doesn't. It comes back to bite you. Debt kills. Okay, so this is a burndown chart of WIDBI, which I got to remember. I think WIDBI was Visual Studio 2005. And this is our burn to beta 1, okay? There's two lines I want you to look at. The red line is the burn down of all the debt, all the bugs that we had accumulated in beta 1, okay? And this is burning down to our goal of shipping here on 4/21/2004. The purple line, anybody know what the purple line is? No, it's not incoming. It's actually total debt on the whole product. So you see what's happening here? We hit the curve. We hit the burn down on beta 1. But we actually didn't touch the debt on the product. We just punted it. We made it go away, right? This is the easiest way to resolve a bug, you know, is go up to the iteration field and change it, right? It's resolved, right? That's what we did. We did that. It was terrible. We had a huge problem. You know, service pack, you know, I don't want to get started, but we had a huge, huge, huge debt problem. And you know, I'm looking at Greg in the back because we still have a debt problem. We still deal with this today. But this is the burn down from the same chart over the next release, the 2008 release, and we did a much better job. And you can see where we started from, too. I mean, I don't know if anybody's paying attention to that number. It's almost 25,000 bugs, 30,000 total, which is crazy, right? Debt was out of control. So we have to be really careful that we're not piling up debt on our projects. I talked to a lot of Agile teams that still kind of treat bugs differently and treat debt differently. And I think if you want to have an environment, if you want to have get rid of a distraction, just start dealing with debt. Just, you know, just deal with it once and for all. We have Mario Rodriguez, who's a PM on our team. Some of you might know him. He's a great guy. And he has this saying. He says, quality for agility. Like, we've got to get to a point of where our quality bar is super, super high. Once we do that, we can be agile. But as long as we're lugging around this anchor behind us of debt, it's really, really difficult to do that. Okay. Another one of my favorites is mixed messages. I think this is my last one, actually. If you stare at that graphic long enough, you'll get it. It's kind of fun. So how many of you guys have kids? Okay, great. We all know that your kids hear everything you say, right? What we think, especially when they're younger. I'm really talking about younger kids because I don't have teenagers yet. But they hear everything you say, but they see everything that you do. And it's scary, right? Have you ever been in one of those situations where you've maybe said something and your three-year-old's around and you had no idea, and then they come and they repeat it later, like in front of a bunch of people, right? We've been there, right? And they hear everything that we say, but they also see everything that we do. And we've got to be really, really careful here that we're not sending mixed messages. And a mixed message is when our actions don't match our words. I see this a lot in terms of Agile. Why? Because I could pop up the Agile manifesto and be like, individuals and interactions, process over processes and tools, you know, customer collaboration. Those are such easy things to say, and they're fun things to say, but oftentimes our actions don't match up with those words. And I think it's a trap that we fall into. So I want to encourage all of you to be really, really careful that you're not sending a mixed message to your team. We've talked about distractions. We've talked about environments. You know, it's easy to tell a team, like, yeah, I trust you. You know, go do the right thing. And then you give them a TPS report. You make them pay a bunch of taxes. You change their priorities on them. You sit through their retrospectives and glare at them when they come up with something that is critical feedback. You know, we do all these things, and we send our teams a mixed message. And I think that we've really got to be self-reflective here and say, do we really believe this Agile stuff? And if we believe it, do our actions actually match our words? Or do we just saying it? Are we just really producing lip service to it? So that's the mixed message aspect. Okay, so that's motivation, environment, and distractions. And here's kind of a summary slide of those things. These are things that, as I was telling Greg in the back, who I work with every day, he's another PM on TFS, that I had a lot of fun when I was preparing for this talk because there was a lot of self-reflection on the way we do stuff around here at Microsoft. And, you know, it's easy even to present on this stuff, but it's hard to go back and actually make it a reality. To really be self-reflective and say, do we understand what our finish line is? Do we have road rules that people understand and aren't getting in the way? Do our teams even understand their purpose? So often we hide feedback from them. We don't let them come to events like this to interact with real customers because we think that would be a distraction. That will get in their way. They need to be focused on writing code. And I think if we did more of that, it actually might be the exact opposite. You know, they'd be more invigorated. So, okay, so that's environment and those things. I'm staring at the clock. I got 12 minutes, and now I'm going to do demo, and then we'll take some questions along the way. So let me switch over, and I'm going to show you guys TFS vNext, if you will. And if you're using the hosted preview product, you're familiar with this already, and you're using it. If you aren't, I think you all got accounts, right, for our hosted preview. You all got sign-ups and stuff for that. So I'd encourage you to go up and sign up and start using it. And I want to talk you through some of the cool new features that we've added that really go to the tactical aspect of managing an Agile project, but won't solve some of those other problems. So let's do that. So first of all, this is our new web interface for TFS. So it probably looks a lot different than you're used to, and it is a lot different. It does run in IE, so you'll notice I'm running it in Chrome, but it runs in IE as well. So that's good. Couple things. First thing is, sometimes we need to reorder our backlog and reprioritize things, right? We've built a fit-for-purpose tool for you guys to do that, for your product backlogs. you no longer, I'm staring at it, do that, because I'm waiting for my VM to wake up. Saving. Now it'll be fast. You no longer need to use Excel to manage your backlogs. You no longer need to export and start dragging numbers around. You simply drag and drop in the backlog. And that's been one of the biggest sort of improvements that we've made to the product right out of the bat. Thank you. Let me show you how this gets really cool. Adding to the backlog is as simple now as turning on our add items and say, let's add something. We're now adding a new PBI. Let's add another. And you'll notice that wherever I pick, the location that I pick, we're automatically adding in that location. Add here. Okay, pretty slick. Pretty cool. You'll notice that a lot of these things have estimates on them because the team has already done some estimating. These are just work items like you're used to. So user stories, PBIs, I don't care, bugs. You call in what you want and you can fill out your effort field. You can customize this little add panel if you want your effort field and things like that to show up. So that's pretty slick. Now if I want to assign something to an upcoming sprint, you'll notice I've got some things assigned to sprint 4 and 5. So course mapping from around, this is my little golf sample site, so it shows you what a golf nerd I am. But if I wanted to assign this to sprint 4, you see what it did there? Did you see it automatically change? It's pretty slick. That is actually changing the iteration path right there, and it's just doing that. So it's just drag and drop, just making those things easy. Now where this gets really cool is up here in the top right, this is our team's velocity. So this is every sprint that we've done. Sprint 1 and 2 are done. We're in the midst of sprint 3. And this is how much effort we've completed in each of those sprints. So you'll notice these are green because they're done. This one's blue because it's in progress. So you can see we're averaging, I don't know, let's just say 13 or 14 story points or units of effort per sprint. So I'm going to go up here and turn on our forecast lines. This is a new feature that if you don't have in the preview today, we now have. So you'll notice that when we did that, we now draw some lines for you right through your backlog and tell you where things are going to land based on your velocity. What's really cool about this is it's live, so I can change it. If I only get 5 units of effort, I'm not even going to get this one done until sprint 6. If I'm doing 20 units of effort, you can see it's changing around and we're going to get a lot more. Let me move that back to 14 and show you that as I drag and drop, everything changes. See how slick that is? Now what's cool about that is we're not actually assigning right now. We're just drawing lines through your backlog. So this is purely visual. And for a product owner and the team, when they're looking at their velocity, we think this is huge. So this has been, it was really exciting when this feature made it in. And we're thrilled to have it there. So we're excited to get it in your hands. Other things down here, you'll notice that we still support hierarchies like we always have. And you can actually adjust and manipulate the hierarchy so I can move an entire parent item all the way up. I can reorder within, and I can actually create hierarchies right here as well. So you'll notice this is a trick. You might not have seen this on the preview, but if you drag up and down, it puts it there. But if you drag over the number, it creates a parent-child relationship between the two. So you can do that as well. So that's really slick. Okay, so that's our product backlog. When we go into executing for a sprint, I'm going to click into sprint 3. So let's go plan or look at what the plan for sprint 3 looks like. I'm going to click on that, and this now represents all of the PBIs or user stories that you've added into that particular sprint, and you can see them displayed here, and we've actually got the hierarchy of all the tasks as well. So if I wanted to add something new to handicap trends over time, I'm going to say new task, and I'm going to put an estimate of 5 hours on it, and save and close it. You'll notice it automatically adds it in there. So some sort of quick adding and decomposition of your sprint backlogs. You'll notice that this is a really big icon. There's a lot of visual stuff going on here that we're in the middle of, so it's still kind of rough. We're working on improving that, but we'll get there. You'll also notice we have this little thing over here called the work details pane. What's that? This is basically capacity planning, and we have a lot of teams that use capacity when they plan. We have a lot of teams that don't care about it. If you don't care about it, you just turn it off and it's gone. Great. If you do care about it, turn it on and use it. I'll quickly explain how it works. First thing is, you've got a team. So you've actually got the concept of a team in Team Foundation Server. Ah, all right, right. Wow. They finally got that. It took us 4 releases. So we're there. Every team member has capacity that they say for the duration of the sprint. So I say, this is really not very reflective. I'm more like 1. But as you notice, we're doing that. we're creating buckets of work over here. This bucket at the top is all the work for the team. This bucket here is our work by discipline. And this bucket down here is work for individuals. So this is really slick because it kind of gives you a bunch of different dials that you can use. And what I tell people is that as they're decomposing their work, if they see green, you just feel good about it. As soon as you start to see some red, it might indicate you need to do some load balancing. And if you want to turn it off and you don't care, that's great as well. What you also might have noticed, you can do days off. So I could come up here and just say, I don't know, let's take tomorrow off. Right? And you'll notice when it does that, it changes capacity as well. So a bunch of that. And you have team days off. So a bunch of stuff there. The other thing that you might be wondering is, well, how did you even know what these dates are? You notice right up there. That's because every iteration now in TFS supports the notion of a start date and an end date. Yeah, there's another one. Four product cycles. We got there. So we've got that on all the work. And you're probably wondering what this is. This is our handy-dandy burndown chart. This is not based off the cube. This is based off live data, and it updates in real time. So when the team is executing on their work, we're not going to save those changes, and they're using the task board, that's new, we can now just use this to move our work through to the end. So remember that tax we were talking about before, updating hours? Well, part of the reason people don't want to update their hours is because it's painful to do, and it's not very much fun. We have spent a lot of time in this release trying to build and add some fun into the product so that teams want to do this, and as they're doing it, watch that little burndown chart, okay? Everybody's eyes are up there. You see it? It's trending down. The Scrum template has a rule on every work item. It automatically zeros out the work or the remaining work, and we just update your burndown for you right when it happens. And if you want to create road rules that say that you need work when you're in certain states, our Scrum template does that. It says if you're going to put something back in progress, you've got to add an estimate. We support all that as well. So whether you're using custom rules, our rules out of the box, it doesn't matter. You're going to get all of this for free. So that's really, really slick. We've got a bunch of different filters here that make this great for running stand-up. So I just filtered by myself for myself, and you'll notice that it highlighted only the work that's assigned to me. And then I can come down here to some of these other things, and you see what it's doing there? It's automatically assigning them as I move them. If I want to reassign it, I can just do that. And if I want to decrement my hours, I can do that as well. And that's real time. Those are live updates on tasks, you know, right there. So there's elimination of some tax. Yeah, go ahead. Yep, great question. So custom templates. So first off, we're shipping three templates this time in the box, Agile CMMI and Scrum. If you've got a custom template, all this works as well. We've got a new configuration layer that sits between the tool, essentially, and your process. So you'll need to set some configuration settings, and we'll have some UI to help you do that. But beyond that, it all works. So just to demonstrate that, I'm going to jump up here, and I'm going to switch over to a CMMI project. And you'll notice when I do that, I don't have anything in my... Hold on, let me add something quickly to iteration zero. And when I move back, you notice that the CMMI template proposed active resolve close. That's because the task work item supports those states. So I don't care if you have 12 states, you have a lot of tax there, or two states, it doesn't matter. We'll support it. And it works, obviously, out of the box for all of our templates. So that's pretty slick. And then a couple more quick things. When you go all the way back and you go to your home page for your project, it now looks like this. This is mid-flight, so there's a lot still that's going to be changing. One of the things you'll notice is we bring your remaining work right here for the current sprint, again, right to the front of the page. We bring your burndown chart right to the front. We also give you these nice little tiles, which are essentially like work item queries and things like that. You can pin them to the home page. So if you've got any blocked tasks, you'll recognize them right away. You click through to that, it takes you right to the query where you can go investigate those blocks tasks. Really slick. This is actually our internal server. I wanted to show you this because I don't have any build definitions on my demo environment, but this is actually a build definition right here. So in our ALM branch, TFS gated, every build that gets kicked off with that build definition shows a little status here. Tells me when the last one was run. These are the actual results for the build definition, and I can click through and go right through and investigate. So you can pin these things there and get really quick up-to-date status right from your homepage. That's pretty slick. final thing, and I don't know, oops, I'm on the wrong project. I want to quickly show you that the notion of team works right out of the gate. So I'm going to take you back to our backlog. You'll notice here I'm on my Scrum project. I have one team on this project, okay? So we're just a small group, and this is our project, and we have a backlog and all that kind of stuff. I've got a more complex environment here, which is in my CMMI project, and I've actually got three teams. I've got the project level team called Top Gun CMMI, and then I've got orange, red, and blue, okay? We're right now on just the what we call the master team or the root team, okay? So you'll notice I've got something here. I can just do my drag and drop, all that kind of normal stuff. But let's add something. Add something. I could type for the red team. Okay? So we're going to add it here. We have a lot of teams that work in this environment. We have multiple teams, a master backlog. You're kind of working off one backlog. When we're ready to go execute in the next sprint, we're going to take this, and we're going to go up and just assign it to the red team. Okay? We did that with our area path field. We've assigned it to the red team. Now watch when I refresh. It's no longer there. I'm going to go over to Top Gun CMMI red team. And there's add something red for the red team, which was assigned. And now I can assign it to an upcoming sprint and start planning on it. So again, we've got this notion of teams. And you can have projects with as many teams as you want internally, just to kind of prove it to you. This is our dog food server. And you can see here's all of our teams within TFS that are using using it. So it all works. And you get, look, even pictures and stuff like that. So some cool stuff. So that's what's coming next. I wanted to make sure that you guys saw that. And I am right out of time.